Hello and welcome to another chapter of the master's thesis entitled User-Generated Content for Design. My name is Alexandre Joyce and I'm finishing my master's in Design and Complexity at the University of Montreal. In this fourth chapter, we will present the results of the study. Then we will answer the questions that were asked in the beginning of this research. What kind of information are users submitting online? And to what type of design output is this information most pertinent? To answer these questions, we will rely on the results we obtain in our field research, and we will discuss these results for each of the three variables: design process, design outputs, and media types. The design process variable is composed of two parts, one inside the other. Firstly, we have described the design process from the perspective of Jones as being a constant forward cyclical movement from the problem space to the creative space to the solution space. Again, we wish to remind our reader that this also refers to Findeli's thinking, judging, and acting loop for a designer dealing with complexity. The second level in the design process is found in each of these three spaces. The design itself can be broken into relationships amongst the user, object, and context. We therefore characterized each piece of collected data into four types of relationships: user-object, object-context, user-context, and user-object-context. The design outputs were described in Chapter 2 as being on an axis separating the product from the service. At one end is the industrial product, and at the other is the purely intangible service. Somewhere in between these two poles, we find product-service systems that offer a product as part of a service. So the design outputs are product design, PSS design, and service design. Although we didn't have a formal research question on the media types we studied, our data does allow us to draw conclusions on what type of media users have been using to express their thoughts within both levels of the design process. In the end, we hope to establish relationships between the variables and the results in order to contrast and compare each element we studied. Finally, we will propose ways to use this information in researching for design. What type of information pertaining to the design process are users submitting online? The short answer is all types of information. When looking for videos pertaining to the problem of mobility with cars, one of our search strategies targeted people driving to and from work. A multitude of users have simply documented their ride home by installing a camera on their dashboard. This gives us the user's point of view and context of the ride back home. What can we gather from these demonstrations of user experience? Is there a common demonstration in use of products, PSS, and services? When it comes to car sharing, a typical video was that of someone swiping their card on the dashboard receiver unit. There were also multitudes of videos of cab rides in New York, which applies to showing the experience of the taxi service. So what do these frequently documented experiences portray? Does it represent the highest area of impact within the whole user experience? Can we generalize by saying that cars are often used for driving to work, taxis are often used by tourists, and car sharing, on the other hand, is relatively new and therefore showing how it works is more on people's mind than how they individually use it? The answer is no, we can't generalize. Using user-generated content for generalization purposes is diminishing the potential of these sources of user content. Generalizing would be trivializing. In fact, no two videos were alike. If we go back to users filming their ride home, in other cases we can actually see the driver's movements as he is filmed by someone sitting in the back seat. Sometimes the car sounds are present, other times a music track has been added to the video. Then, there are those who have accelerated the frame rate of the video 16 times to show a longer journey in a few minutes. And finally, in this sub-series of driving to work, another driver shows off how he dangerously weaves through traffic going to work late. No matter how similar we all feel the drive to work is, when it comes to actually submitting content online, everyone has a different approach and a different story to tell. The internet has enabled designers to witness the complexity of the situation. To put it briefly, our research indicates that all aspects pertaining to the design process were covered by user-generated content. The following paragraphs will show, with many examples, how users participated in the three spaces of the design process. Each of these spaces seems to beg a different theoretical question, which will begin a longer discussion on how this information can serve the researching designer. The problem space. Some users that presented elements of the problem space were simply demonstrating a situation they were living. Whether it be the video of a user driving directly against oncoming traffic in India, a blog entry that exposes car sharing stats, or an image of a person hailing a cab, the information that is found in the problem space comes from documenting their point of view and their everyday activities. Even though driving against traffic isn't an everyday activity in North America, it can be in India. The situation becomes a problem when seen with the eyes of the designer. Hailing a cab in New York can be frustrating. Thus, starting from this image of a woman with her hand out leads to imagining new ways of hailing a cab with a colorful LED light the size of a ring, for example. So in these cases, the situation or activity wasn't presented as a problem, but was in fact part of the problem space. Inversely, some users did present their situation as a problem. For example, the woman who entitled her video, "Should you smoke in your car?" This user is fully conscious that driving with a cigarette is a problem. Although, trying to look fabulous, we see her a little flustered while handling her cigarette and changing gears. The image of a car-sharing website that got hacked revealed the problem of security. And this user also speaks of security as he is aware that taking a taxi can be a leap of faith. If you decide to take a taxi to work, you will have to trust your life to the vehicle and the taxi driver. These cases show that elements of the problem space have been clearly identified by the users. They are participating in determining what the initial situation that needs to change is. This begs the question, how can designers learn from the point of view of the user? In researching the shift from user-centered to participatory design approaches, Sanders has been a pioneer in helping the user articulate his unspoken feelings, unexperienced need, and unthought desires. Starting from one's innate visual abilities, she has created the games, tools, and experiences that simplify the involvement of participants in the design process, and thus enrich what can be extracted from the process by the designers. So far, in professional participatory design, the focus has been on need-intensive tasks involved in developing a particular type of product or service, which is assigned to users, along with the tools needed to carry out those tasks. At the same time, solution-intensive tasks were assigned to manufacturers. This contrasts with our research, where both needs and solutions can come from users. The coming together of the various practices of science in formulating the problem space and the creative leap implied in the solutions place is where Sanders sheds new light on the design process. By believing that people want to express themselves and participate directly and proactively in the design development process, she has actually developed tools and strategies to do so. In fieldwork such as videotaping participant observations and follow-up interviews, designers can understand the nuances of users' everyday practices. Sanders uses many diagrams to illustrate her research findings, all to show users' capacity to express themselves. Sanders shows many inverted pyramid models, all with the same general idea of the user's capacities to express themselves. From saying, thinking, doing, using, knowing, feeling, and dreaming, users communicate their explicit, observable, tacit, and latent knowledge. The following table quickly synthesizes and the subtleties and relationships between what users create and the nature of their self-expression. However, Sanders' inverted pyramid model better suggests that there is more quantity and simplicity of communication at the top. Similarly to Sanders' findings, our research shows that users are providing elements of the problem space from which designers can extract explicit, observable, and even tacit needs. Although Sanders' methodology can be without a doubt more targeted to the design problem at hand, our own methodology can be applied quickly and without much effort to get a pulse on the user's point of view. The solution space. The solution space isn't characterized by being conscious or not of the problem because the information presented is already addressing a problem. However, Much of the content provided which referred to the solution space was extremely focused on one single aspect. When a midwife shows how to deliver a baby in a taxi, this situation within the greater idea of mobility isn't a common occurrence. Maybe taxis should be equipped with an emergency baby delivery kit. When looking at the picture of the dashboard of a car-sharing vehicle service, we see an onboard computer. It becomes the starting point for a process similar to reverse engineering, reverse designing. The same way reverse engineering takes objects apart to understand each element, as a designer, we study the solution elements of the system. We begin guessing how it all works together, how the user can benefit from the way the system is set up. Does the screen give information pertaining to the distance, time, and cost of the trip? Can you search for available parking? His car answers his need for freedom. I really value my independence, and I don't think I know what I'd do without it. The solution space content is very narrow-minded and lacks the bigger picture perspective that design process requires. Even by adding up all these elements of solution spaces, the needs addressed remain quite varied. Nevertheless, the information pertaining to the solution space can be recycled into elements of the problem space of the researching designer. Therefore, we ask, can the user's point of view on the solutions become a starting point for designers to create better experiences? As described in Chapter 2, a change in concept can come from seeing the new in terms of the old. That is to use the situation at hand to change our perception of the old. This is a shift. Sean calls it displacement of concept, describing it as making the old interdependent of the new, arriving to a new gestalt. New concepts happen as a result of this shift. While remaining in a form of reflective practice, designers can reflect and add upon the user's generated content, which is unbiased by design education or culture. The process is similar to the professional participatory design process proposed by Bodker. Ultimately, we propose this brainsourcing as a parallel activity to the designer's original brainstorming. While still involved with researching for design, the designer's perspective on the sum of the participants' ideas can help him to better understand the bigger picture, the complex systems, and the emergent schemes. The collective aspect of the participatory design process can help generate more ideas by resonating within the user group and thus rebounding into another idea in displacement of concepts. In Praquin's Design and Complexity Master's Memoir on Collective Idea Generation, it was difficult for the participants to detach themselves from their personal perspectives and see the world from another's point of view. This comes with no surprise, as Sean, who has proposed the theory on idea generation, was also aware of these limits. In this case, Sean makes clear that, and I quote, "closed-minded and narrow-minded describe not only the pathological conviction, but conviction generally, and conviction is necessary for directed action. Often, the most striking and innovative solutions come from realizing that your concept of the problem was actually wrong." For displacement of concepts to happen in participatory design, the creation of a common language or translation between the participants and the users is most critical aspect. It was therefore expected and comprehensible that the participants might not engage in the concept-shifting aspect of the process proposed by Praquin. However, within this participatory-like process, designers can learn from the content provided by the users and use it as a starting point towards concept shifting. In other words, the user-generated content provides food for the designer's research as he moves into the creative space. The creative space. The users who present creative content display the highest potential material for the design process. They are participating in the process of design by submitting their ideas, their wishes, or their original points of view on the situation. Their level of participation requires the highest amount of effort because it demands a personal involvement in bringing change to the situation. These users are engaged in making a difference. When a user makes a stop-motion video with Lego figurines to present the simplicity of car sharing, he is making a point through his creative scenario. The next case in the creative space is different because it shows a creative use of the media that is blogging. This user utilized her blog to ask if anyone wants to share a cab to the airport. And I quote, "I'm leaving at 4 p.m. to get there 5-ish. Save us both time and cash." The creativity here is not only linked to the problem of mobility by forecasting the wish to split a cab, but also it shows creative use of the media itself. The melancholic image of a rainy drive home reveals the feeling associated with daily mobility. In reality, it is the creative Photoshop work with filters on the image that gives off that emotion. In this case, the creativity serves no greater purpose. It's more a question of creating a new perspective on the problem. It's a direction taken without much rational underpinning. This makes us ponder. What is this gap between reason and creation? The primary generator is the first step when the designer begins moving into the creative space. When the pencil finally marks the white page and begins working towards creatively solving the problem. When enunciating the concept of primary generator in the design process, Drake also stumbled upon the rationality gap that exists between what is on paper and how it can forecast the thinking that gave it life. And I quote from Jane Dark, "Clearly, in some cases where architects have described their own process of design, a visual image came very early in the process. In other cases, it appears a certain amount of preliminary analysis takes place before the visual concept arises. It seems normal, however, for there to be a rationality gap. Either the visual concept springs to mind before the rational justifications for such a form, or the analysis does not dictate this particular concept rather than others. The concept or objective that generates a solution is here called the primary generator. It can in fact be a group of related concepts rather than a single idea. These objectives form a starting point for the architect, a way into the problem. He does not start by listing all the constraints. Any particular primary generator may be capable of justification on a rational ground, but at the point when it enters the design process, it is usually more of an article of faith on the part of the architect, a designer-imposed constraint, not necessarily explicit." So when looking at some of the creative content of the users, we find that rationality gaps are remarkably present. Sometimes, it can be as simple as not understanding why the user created this content. For example, an image of a cat taxi driver driving a scared mouse, a grimacing New York taxi driver, or this evocative image of a woman driver's foot seen through the steering wheel where the word airbag is out of focus. In these cases, like Drake exposed, an image is so powerful that it is hard to understand what its implications for the ensuing design are. So again, we ask, how can user-generated creative content serve designers? The task of getting users to create themselves starts with emphasizing the difficulty in waking the creativity within. As we have mentioned, Sanders has been a pillar in developing such field study methods and design activities to build the bridges that lead the user to use his own knowledge and apply it to idea generation. The goal of the designer is to integrate, and I quote, "systemic analysis, appreciative intervention, and practitioner participation to create conditions that reduce the gap between the design vision and the user's reason." Before moving on to the next discussion on the variables of this research, the creative space revealed content that brings a capital question. We thought it important to raise this question here, although it will further be debated in the next chapter. This next example is the most fruitful aspect of the creative space. From the comfort of her bed, this user wants to improve mobility with a taxi service by proposing a golf cart shuttle service from the mall. She begins a conversation by inviting other YouTube users to respond and continue the discussion. The creative space is characterized by the idea of a project. In other words, it is characterized by the possibility of change. Amidst this vast amount of content on the internet, some users are actively participating by submitting the creative ideas to solve problems. Can those users be considered designers? We will look into this question in the next chapter. What are our answers to the research questions? Are users providing information pertinent to research for design? The answer to that question is evidently positive. Potentially, all aspects of the relationships between users, objects, and contexts have been addressed by user-generated content. We will now review a few examples of how each of the four categories were in fact tackled in terms of videos, images, and blogs we collected. User objects. The relationship between the user and the object has revealed an emotional attachment, like in the case of this user who loved his car before his crash. And I quote, "My car is like my backbone." This relationship can also take on the form of special use of the object, referred to earlier as exceptions, when many users at a time are squeezed into the backseat of a cab, for example. Also, the content provided by the users, like in the case of this car-sharing barrier troubleshooting video, reveals the user-object relationship as a how-to or an instructional video to proper use for the proper use of the object. This was also a part of our initial research in Chapter 2, where Courage and Baxter were calling it standard steps. Objects and contexts. The object-context relationship might seem paradoxical because it is void of the user and at the same time, it is the user who is submitting the content. The picture of cars in wet snow portrays this relationship even though the user taking the picture isn't part of the content. We focus on the contextual conditions and how the object must respond to such an environment. Inversely, in this video, showing simple images of cars, the titles explain how the car's characteristics can be put to profit in a car-sharing service. Again, referring to the theoretical description in Chapter 2, we relate this to norms that should be implemented. In the blog entries, the relationship between the object and the context is explanatory, revealing the rationale behind certain policies of the product service system. And I quote, "Cars are less likely to be involved in an accident if they are being driven less. Thus, car insurance companies appreciate this lower risk and lower the prices appropriately." This comment on the insurance policy links back to the notion of a structure of a system. Users and contexts. The user-context relationship is characterized by elements of the experience that don't include the object. The simple walk to the car parking lot is definitely part of using a car. This video doesn't feature the vehicle until the very last 10 seconds. Basically, the user was showing the 2-minute walk that she takes to actually get to her car. Therefore, this relationship overextends the object and is mostly present before and after the use of the object. The image of all the content in someone's wallet shows the context in which the car sharing service card is kept and divulges the identity that users wish to portray as a form of style. From this blog entry on taxi services, we see that the user is providing insight into the context of getting out of the house 20 minutes late for work and how the taxi service is the solution. By exposing the mindset in which people operate, for instance, when running late, we are studying such elements as culture. Users, objects, and contexts. Where all the three elements of the design are present, the experience of the design is concerned. The content that shows relationships amongst all these three elements is more evocative of the design situation. Simply put, an image of a car in a parking lot focuses on specific parts of the design situation, whereas a panorama picture of a user in his car driving down the freeway reveals a greater perspective pertaining to the design situation. The presence of the three elements adds to the richness of the demonstration of the experience. For example, this blog entry speaks of how the taxi ride provides a breathing space and gives the user some alone time. This blog entry reveals the informal structures that subconsciously worked towards creating experiences. The experience that is portrayed in the video of a car wash ride, complete with the laid-back 70s music and soap buds on the windshield, is telling of the cleansing atmosphere that not only makes your car shine, but makes the user feel clean too. This illustration of a slower movement is part of the experience flow. In summary, all aspects of the user-object-content relationship are present in the user-generated content. It is up to the designer to target the relationships most pertinent to his research in order for the user content to provide deeper understanding of the situation. Is the information provided by the users more pertinent in designing products, product service systems, or services? Comparing the results qualitatively in terms of the design outputs reveals little insight because the data collected has been as present and diverse in all three cases. It is true, however, that finding information on car sharing was a little more difficult. We attribute this to the fact that this is a rather new system. Nonetheless, we have found some differences in qualitative terms. We wish to strongly preface that the results we will show in the next section are representative of a general approach to searching user-generated content. As we have suggested earlier, if a researcher wishes to pursue a certain aspect of the design process or a certain user-object-context relationship, it is possible to filter out or focus in on any given aspect. Also, some content could have been classified as part of two categories, but we choose to limit each piece of content to one information relevant to one aspect of the design process and one relationship. Lastly, we wish to remind the reader of the complexity of this research with respect to the ever-evolving content on these websites of user participation. The first graph we show compiles the data collected by adding up the content relevant to the problem, solution, and creative spaces. The biggest element of discussion here is that more than half of the content submitted about the products is pertinent to the problem space. It is the only significant majority of this graph. If it wasn't for that spike, we could conclude that all three outputs attract similar amounts of content in each of the design spaces. On another front, the most significant conclusion that can be drawn is that one out of every four submissions is creative. And this is a constant amongst the three design outputs. Users are creative no matter whether speaking of products, PSS, or services. The second graph compares the different relationships when researching for design contrasted with the design outputs. The first element of discussion here is the three extremely low results. In our research, we collected little product information in terms of object-context relationship. This comes to no surprise. The users we researched provided content from their point of view, which usually implies their presence. Very rarely have users talked about their products without including themselves in the process. This comes in opposition to the way experts detach themselves from the products they study. Our research shows that users aren't providing rational, objective content. They are providing their opinions and personal experience with their products. This refers to the knowledge versus meaning debate we explored earlier. Secondly, little product service system or service information pertaining to the user context relationship was provided. Inversely, in the product output, the user context relationship was the most collected. At first, this comes as a surprise. Why would the relationships implicating the object be more present in services and PSS than within products? We propose a tentative answer. The importance of the object is more of a preoccupation to the user in cases of services and PSS. This is what Hollins calls touchpoints. They are tangibles or interactions that make up the total experience of a service. Because of the intangible nature of the services and PSS, the user turns his attention to that which he can physically interact and take a certain form of ownership. The car sharing service results showed many users enjoying the idea of using a car they wouldn't otherwise have had the chance to drive. Some users deem worthy posting pictures of their Flickr account of a hybrid Prius, a sporty Mini, and a large SUV. In a few words, users are highly impacted by the products within a PSS. This is a great discovery that creates a heavy argument for furthering the implication of designers in the elaboration of services and PSS. The second element of discussion coming from this graph is the three high rises. We have already seen how user context relationship is very high in products compared to PSS and services. This links PSS and services in terms of their results. One element of the PSS does stand out. As foreseen in Chapter 2, the holistic experience is indeed a significant factor for the design of product service systems. We ask ourselves why users provide so much content about the experience of car sharing. We believe that users who take part in a PSS are more active in the use phase and aren't concerned with the other factors such as repairs, modifications, or other surrounding elements of the product. These other elements were quite present in the product-related content. For instance, the three roommates that share their story of how they rented a Zipcar in San Francisco to participate in a triathlon in San Jose. The main basis of their video was to show how they used the car as a means and not an end. This contrasts with some videos where the users show the process of renting out a car. The user breaks it down into three steps, while another shows it as a continuous experience. In some videos that showcase the experience of driving one's vehicle, the user becomes the focal point of the video because the main content is the user driving to the coffee shop or the frustration of being stuck in traffic. This reiterates how even though one would think that videos of people driving their car would be centered on the object, it is in fact the user that commands most of the attention. In the case of the service, we see content similar to that of a car sharing, where the main focus of the video isn't the taxi or the user, but the experience of using the taxi service as an impromptu overnight hotel. This creates a divergence between products where the focus of the experience is mostly on the individual user, and the services where the focus is on the experience itself. How did users employ each type of media? Although the focus of this research is mostly on the design process, we did collect data on the different media types. The following graphs provide much insight into the way users naturally use videos, images, and blogs to communicate their point of view. This graph was constructed by adding all of the content of the products, PSS, and services in each media type, then classifying it depending on which area of the design space it refers to. We start by pointing out the large variance between problem, solution, and creative spaces in the blogs and the relative balance in the videos and images. The results for the blogs show that users are more inclined to present elements of the problem in their writings. This comes as no surprise, since words can convey their thoughts and feelings on the situation. Furthermore, users provided elements in the creative space half as often when writing in blogs. This leads us to think that images and moving images are more suited to portraying elements of creativity. In other words, our study shows that users are potentially twice as creative with images as with words. This ties back to the age-old saying of an image is worth a thousand words. Now we direct our attention to comparing the videos and the images. Interestingly, it seems as though the results are inversed when it comes to the solution space. Videos weren't the medium of choice when presenting solutions, whereas images seem to better convey the solution aspect of user-generated content. There isn't a significant margin to identify a trend here, but just enough to ask the question, why were videos less used to present solutions? Our first tentative answer would be that videos are by nature closely related to time and present progress. The solution space is often fixed in time. It presents a finished step, an accomplishment, a realized project, or an existing answer to a problem space. Thus, videos are less likely to feature such a fixed result. Take this example of a university campus that has its own car sharing service on campus, where the narrator simply speaks in front of the camera to explain the initiative they have put forth. Although this is a video, no movement is required to describe the solution. An image with some text could have conveyed the same information. The second graph takes into account the media types by adding all the content of each design relationship, no matter the design output. By comparing all three media types, we notice that each one tells a different story. The videos have been widely used to express the experience of the user. This reinforces the idea that videos are sensitive to time and flow. User experiences are closely linked to the scenarios thought out by designers. The designers who worked with Manzini in everyday sustainable projects proposed video sketching to give a sense of the experience. Similar to the design service of that scenario, the user films his own experience. What's truly amazing is that some users are actually creating scenarios of their own, much like designers would. The second highest reoccurrence is the user-object relationship that also refers to use of the design. Videos void of the context can be taken in studio to emphasize the user-object relationship, but the users in our research didn't employ that technique. Rather, they simply don't take into account the context. They solely focus on the user and, in this case, her love for the car-sharing service. The same can be argued for this video, entitled Driving Skills, featuring, and I quote, the car and the driver. The video does take place in a particular parking lot in the road. But it could be any parking lot or any road of any country. So in the end, a vast majority of videos are used to showcase users using the objects sometimes with and sometimes without taking into account the context. Images, the second media type, show great potential in depicting one specific relationship of the design, the object context. Why would most content reveal elements of this relationship between the object and the context? The answer comes from the absence of the user. Taking pictures of users can be intimidating for the photographer, as well as intimidating for the protagonist. Taking pictures without the user is a much simpler task. Everything remains still for the framing of the picture to be well planned. Take this picture of the user's car as seen in the mirror of another car. Would this mirror fixed to the back of the car be an altruistic device to help other drivers see if a child is in front of their own car? Nonetheless, the user isn't present in these pictures, and the focus shifts from the relationship between the objects and the context. Another example is this car that was damaged when left in the parking lot for 2 months. The object-context relationship also allows for great images of artistic merit, like this one of a car going into a tunnel. Lastly, blogs have told the opposite story of the images. The object-context relationship is not as present as in any other relationship. This is simply attributed to the fact that most blogs are written in the first-person point of view. This means that the user is often at the center of the content, retracing themselves as an impartial observer would, and discussing the object in context doesn't seem to be the reason for which users are participating in blogs. Take this rare counterexample of the founder of car sharing, Portland, who blogged about the business model of other services. He blurs the line between user and expert as he analyzes the pros and cons of the system that was designed in Germany. Far more common are the personal perspectives given from the user's standpoint. This user described his whole experience with the Philly car sharing service, and I quote, "I drove a Toyota Prius, which was a treat in itself. I actually felt smarter driving in that thing about town." This last citation further exemplifies and links back to the idea that the object, as a central touchpoint, has a high impact on the user. From our results, we see that bloggers usually employ the first-person point of view, and therefore, the ensuing design relationships that involve the user. Now, as designers, what have we learned from this research? By looking at the results in terms of the three variables, we are able to learn how users have been naturally and yet unknowingly contributing to the design process. It is through the eyes of the designer that user-generated content can leap into the design process. Content pertaining to the problem space was a good example of how some users were conscious and explicit of the problem, as well as how some other users were coping with a problem situation that could require a designer's intervention. We then examined how helping the user express his point of view can in turn help designers frame the problem space. The content that related to the solution space showed existing products and services to answer the user's needs. So as designers, we are prompted to use this existing solution and propose alternate approaches in concept shifting. Thus, the user's point of view on solutions helps designers enter their own creative space. The creative content we have studied has brought up the concept of a rationality gap. Some users create breathtaking content, but to no ulterior purpose. Others create content that seems to emulate that of a designer by offering their point of view on a preferred situation and then on initiating change. Here, the idea of potentiality pervades the content. We then moved further into the design process to understand how users were providing information pertinent to design research in terms of user-object-context relationships. Studying examples from each of the four relationships revealed the presence of the concepts that were used to characterize these relationships in Chapter 2, notably exceptions, standard steps, norms, structure, style, culture, informal structures, and movement. We believe that, if needed, all concepts can be found in the content present online. It's just a question of finding the right keywords for the search engine to bring back these types of concepts in the results. Based on a quantitative combination of the results, we were able to determine for which of the three design outputs users were more inclined to provide information. We cross-referenced the content concerned with the two levels of the design process with the three types of design outputs. We then focused on the design spaces. We noticed that more than half of the content submitted about products is pertinent to the problem space. What's more, one out of every four submissions was relevant to the creative space. When looking at the second level of the design process in the relationships at play, we were able to discover even greater outcomes. Firstly, rarely have users talked about their products without including themselves in the process. They aren't detached from the content they provide. Secondly, the relationships implicating the object are more present in services and PSS than in products. We believe that because of the intangible nature of the services and PSS, the user turns his attention to that which he can physically interact and take a certain form of ownership. Thirdly, users provided much content about their experience of their PSS. We attributed this finding to the fact that users who take part in PSS are more active in the use phase and aren't concerned with other factors such as repairs, modification, and other secondary elements of the product. Fourthly, we observed a divergence between products where the focus of the experience is mostly on the individual users and services where the focus is on the experience itself. Still based on the quantitative analysis of the results, we were able to establish with which of the three media types users chose to submit content relevant to the two levels of the design process. Just like when speaking of their products, users have been more inclined to present elements of the problem space in their blog writings. In contrast, users provided elements in the creative space twice as often when submitting videos and images. We concluded that images and videos are more suited to portraying elements of creativity. However, when it comes to presenting elements of the solution space, videos weren't the medium of choice. Images seem to better convey the fixed aspect of solutions to design problems. We then contrasted the second level of the design process with the three media types. Because videos are sensitive to time and flow, they were widely used to express the experience of the user. In the end, most videos were used to showcase users using the objects. On the other hand, images depicted one specific relationship of the design, the object-context relationship. Taking pictures without the user is a much simpler task. Lastly, blogs are written in the first-person point of view, directly implicating the user in the ensuing relationships. So far, we have learned how user-generated content is pertinent to the design process. We have also described how designers can use this content in researching for design. Now we are left with one last line of questioning. Is the internet democratizing the design process? Are users becoming designers? The next chapter will circle back to our initial research on complexity, the internet, and this field study to begin responding to these formidable questions. And that concludes Chapter 4 of User-Generated Content for Design. Once again, my name is Alexandre Joyce, wishing you all the best.